Like it or not, the senior and elderly population is vulnerable to negligence committed by medical professionals, nursing home and assisted living facilities, pharmaceutical and medical device companies, insurance companies, and everyday individuals and businesses. The Injured Senior Podcast is here to help. Steve Heisler is the creator of the National Injured Senior Law Center and has been advocating for seniors' rights for over 20 years. You have questions, and Steve Heisler has answers. This is the Injured Senior Podcast.
Greetings, Injured Senior community. This is attorney Stephen H. Heisler, founder and CEO of the National Injured Senior Law Center, coming to you from steamy Baltimore, Maryland. Yes, we are recording this episode in early July, and the heat in early July in Baltimore can be staggering. It can be very, very suffocating. I actually pondered recording this episode inside my kitchen refrigerator, but I couldn't fit in there. It was just it was going to be too cramped. So I had to turn down the air conditioning and just go for it. But it's great to be with you. Anyway, you are dialed into the Injured Senior Podcast, where we strive to educate and discuss issues of importance to the injured senior and elderly population and to the children and loved ones of the injured senior and elderly population. I am your humble host. One more thing, my friends. I started this podcast with the intent on sharing information with you that might help prevent you from becoming an injured senior or elder. So that is a major motivation for doing this podcast. For example, we had wound specialist Martha Kelso on the show in episode 2 to discuss bed sores and pressure ulcers in long-term care facilities. She acknowledged that a lot of residents in these facilities get bed sores and pressure ulcers. I won't say it's very common, but it's very prevalent in the aging population for a number of reasons. And she shared with us that bed sores and pressure ulcers are a big problem, especially in long-term care facilities. But she shared with us that they're avoidable. And she gave us a lot of good tips on how to prevent these from happening. Two of the tips that she gave was that nutrition and proper medication management can help reduce you or your loved one's chances of getting a bed sore or a pressure ulcer. And that was very, very vital information. She also shared so much more in that episode. So I invite you all to go back to episode 2 of the Injured Senior Podcast and check it out, because I think you'll get some information on not only how to deal with having a bed sore or pressure ulcer, or your loved one having a bed sore or pressure ulcer, but also how to prevent it. So we received so much positive feedback from our injured senior community regarding her important advice and information in episode 2 that we asked Martha Kelso to come back for another episode, and she said yes. So if you're not familiar with Martha Kelso, you should know she's truly an expert in the area of wound care. She's the president and CEO of Wound Care Plus, LLC, which folks is the largest wound care provider in the Midwest. And actually, they've been so successful that she's now in Florida. I believe she's in New York. So she's on her way to becoming a national mobile wound care company. Her company uses the most innovative products and cutting-edge technology to treat individuals with wound care or skin issues at almost any site of care. And Martha's educated thousands of healthcare professionals and caregivers on wound care issues, federal regulations, and national guidelines. She's a published author and on several national advisory boards. Injured senior community, Martha Kelso, is definitely the real deal when it comes time to wound care. So we are excited to have Martha back today to have her talk about wounds in general this time, especially those that deeply affect the senior and elderly population. Welcome back, Martha. How you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me back, Steve. It's always fun to come join your podcast.
Oh, we are so blessed to have you, and we have missed you.
Oh, thank you.
You have been missed. So we're really happy to get you on and talk about wound care. So let's jump right into it. Now, we talked about bed sores and pressure ulcers in episode 2 when you were here last time. Now, bed sores and pressure ulcers are wounds, correct?
That's correct. Absolutely. Anything that is a break in the skin or maybe damaging the underlying tissue, you could define as a wound or an ulcer, some type of damage to the tissue or skin, something that needs addressed and paid attention to.
Right. And the bed sores and pressure ulcers that we talked about in long-term care settings, I believe you said that they are normally at least caused, and there's comorbidities that add to the elder or senior being more susceptible to getting a bed sore or pressure ulcer, but they're mostly caused by actual pressure from, you know, sitting in one position for too long or shearing and the like. Is that accurate?
I totally agree. Yes.
Okay. And bed sores and pressure ulcers, you also said last time, are more prevalent in the aging population. And it was such a great episode. And I earlier encouraged our listeners to go back to that episode and listen to it. But we're going to talk about wounds in general today. We're going to expand our focus. What type of wounds would you say are most common in the senior and elderly community?
Yeah, I would say that, and this is just generic averages, but about 25% of the time, wounds are pressure, 25% of the time, arterial, 25% venous, and then the other 25% are variety, right? Surgical wounds that haven't healed, maybe an autoimmune disorder, like pemphigoid disorders, could be diabetic wounds. And so we see a wide variety. Sometimes wounds are misdiagnosed. So we're calling things pressure. I just published an article called Why All the Pressure, about pressure. And we see a lot of wrong diagnosis or wrong assumptions. There are times where we're calling wounds pressure, but they don't act like a pressure ulcer. In other words, if we're relieving pressure from that site and they have adequate nutrition, and yet the wound still is not healing, then we go back and say, why isn't that healing? So there's times where we're biopsying wounds to find out that they're cancer, and yet we're mislabeled as pressure.
Wow. That can be extremely scary to think that they're treating you for a pressure ulcer or for something which is a wound when it actually is cancer. Mm-hmm. So are you saying, Martha, that there are misdiagnoses that are happening where the medical profession or long-term care settings are actually not properly diagnosing these wounds and they actually are cancer?
Correct. So in the document that I published called Why All the Pressure, About Pressure, I list two cases that were wrong diagnosis cases. And we do have situations where the primary care physician, the medical director, or even, you know, another specialist like vascular surgeons, we've ordered studies to determine the etiology, like potential arterial disease. So we're ordering an ABI or arterial ultrasound. And they're canceling our orders saying, nope, it's pressure. It's clear that it's pressure. Let's list it as pressure and move on. And then, you know, as things don't progress with that wound, then maybe 3 or 4 months down the road, they allow that study to be ordered and find out that there's a 90% occlusion of an artery. So without adequate blood flow, that wound is not going to heal. So I won't just say it's just nursing homes or just the bedside nurse. I would say it's a systemic issue in healthcare.
Well, why is that? I mean, is that because for lack of just general training about wounds, or why is this happening so much?
And I think that's a great, you know, what is the definition of a wound specialist? And what's interesting is in the healthcare world, taxonomy codes are what define what a doctor or nurse practitioner does. So a taxonomy code may list them as a general surgeon, an emergency medicine physician. There is no taxonomy code for wound care. There is one for hyperbaric oxygen, but there is not one for wound care, which basically means anybody can decide that they're a wound specialist. There are certification programs and board certification programs out there that specialists can take. However, the majority of them require that you've been doing wound care for at least 2 years before you're eligible to sit for the board certification. So I believe in getting board certified in wound care. At the same time, experience over and over and over and over and over again is what differentiates between a good wound specialist versus someone that maybe doesn't know what they're doing.
But has wound care been kind of like dropped to the bottom as far as priorities for the medical establishment? Shouldn't it be required that they become certified in wound care, not only long-term care setting employees or directors or nurses, but also the actual, you know, internist or doctors in general?
Well, that's an opinion answer. In my opinion, we have to have more training in wound care. I've been in the industry 27 years, and even when I went years ago for my LPN program, there was zero wound care training in our LPN program. And my very first job was at a hospital as an LPN. And I can remember the doctor coming out of the room saying, he needs to get a wound vac put on, go put it on. And it was that inherent, oh my gosh, I don't know how to do a wound vac. And then feeling guilty, but you're a nurse, you should know how to do wound care. Well, you're right, I should know. But yet nobody had trained me. And so some of it is the industry having to say, forget it, not one more day. We have to have wound training in our doctor's programs, in NP school, PA school, LPN, RN, PT. The whole industry kind of needs to stop. Some people are making good headway and adding that into their programs, but it's certainly not universal.
Wow, that is really, really disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that more awareness can be brought to wound care and to the importance of our medical professionals becoming, they don't necessarily have to become experts, but have to become a lot more educated and competent in diagnosing these and treating these.
Mm-hmm, correct.
Yeah. So I want to get back to wounds as far as how they relate to the aging population. So wounds, I think you said, are common in the aging population, correct?
Correct. I think anytime you have somebody with multiple comorbidities, multiple diagnoses, and then you add age on top of it, the skin is kind of it's the barometer, right? It kind of tells us what's going on inside the body. Skin's an organ. So if our body is not in a state of homeostasis or balance, we get out of balance. The skin is usually one of the things that shows that imbalance, whether it's through a rash or a breakdown in an ulcer or a dry patchy spot or, you know, blister formation.
So if a person is generally not healthy or has a lot of comorbidities, does an ulcer just break out? I mean, I usually, in my mind, I always thought a wound is something that you fall and you scrape your knee, or if something, there's been some type of trauma to the skin, but is it more of a barometer of just the general health of the person who's affected by it?
Generally speaking, most times that's the case. So to give you an example, if you put a rubber band around your finger and decided not to take it off, how long would it be before the tip of your finger fell off?
I don't know.
Yeah,
tell me.
We don't want to find out, right? But that's the nature of arterial disease. So
okay.
Some smoked for 40 years. They may not be smoking now, but they have 40 years of damage to their blood flow system, their cardiovascular system. So you think about your toes being as far away from the heart as possible. Literally, it's the furthest thing away from your heart and your body. So when you start seeing little ulcerations pop up on the toes, the feet, and the ankles, you should instantly think arterial disease, which means you should be getting an arterial study to prove that it is arterial disease or not. The reason that we would maybe start with an arterial study is because you want to rule out the bad things first. So if there is a blockage, we can get them out to a vascular surgeon, in theory, have that blockage removed and the blood flow reopened. So we're not continuing with that rubber band around their toes, right? With no blood flow.
Got it.
That's just one example of an underlying medical condition that commonly creates wounds.
So in that Wound Care magazine article that I referred to earlier, it was mentioned that approximately 25% of the senior and elderly community actually have diabetes, which is alarming. And that's according to the CDC. So how chronic are diabetic foot ulcers? And is that an arterial issue? Is that a venous issue? And then how systemic is it?
Yeah, so diabetes is an atherosclerosis issue, more like hardening of the arteries, which also impairs the microvascular blood flow. So the capillaries that are feeding, you know, blood, nutrients, oxygen to your tissue are impaired. And the interesting thing is that anybody that's had diabetes for any length of time, even if you managed your blood sugars perfectly, you will still end up with microvascular impairment and atherosclerosis. So somebody that the longer you've had diabetes, the more damage there is. You know, diabetic wounds are generally going to occur in the lower extremity, but diabetic lesions can occur anywhere on the body. So for example, there's different conditions like acanthosis nigricans that can cause various rashes or skin impairments throughout the body. There are numerous diabetic lesions or rashes that occur, but because people are not aware of them or maybe have not been exposed to them, they get underdiagnosed and underrecognized. And then also, pre-diabetes still acts like diabetes in the skin. So people will say, oh, I'm not diabetic, I'm pre-diabetic. Well, that means you still have microvascular impairment. So it will act like a diabetic ulcer, even if you don't have full-blown diabetes.
So not being able to control your blood sugar ultimately results in this, how do you pronounce it again?
Atherosclerosis. Even if you control your blood sugars, but you have diabetes for 40 years, you will still end up with atherosclerosis.
Okay. And then that leads to, you know, the wounds at the feet, because the feet are the farthest from the heart and the blood flow is affected and circulation is not good. Is that correct?
Correct. So, and following that same school of thought, let's say they don't have diabetes, but they've had a heart attack or a stroke. That is a huge clue that they have significant arterial disease throughout their body. Even if they don't have wounds on their lower extremities yet, the fact that they've already had a heart attack or a stroke means that they are at high risk of developing wounds of their lower extremity because they have some form of blood flow impairment throughout their body.
Okay, got it. Now, you have listed on the, and we were talking about it before we started the episode, but you have a document on your website that goes over all the different types of wounds. And that document is the 360-degree wound care document?
Correct. 360 degrees of wound care. And it's just kind of a document that lists some of the more common wound types or skin issues that we treat, my company treats. But we listed that on the document so that it lets people know, man, there's literally thousands of different types of wound or skin issues out there. Thousands.
Well, that's interesting because when I looked at it, I was flabbergasted. I really was shocked because, like, for instance, shingles, which actually is identified as, it's actually a form of herpes.
Mm-hmm, correct.
And shingles is considered a wound. And I just I don't know. I just never thought of it as a wound. Again, I'm coming from a background, and I think a lot of our listeners probably are coming from a background of a wound is something which has to happen traumatically. But actually, shingles is a skin condition, and it is considered a wound. So how is it that the shingles or that the herpes becomes a wound?
Yeah, so with shingles, oftentimes it's starting along the nerve line. And what happens then is it kind of erupts into a blister. Anybody that's had shingles, oftentimes they'll complain of pain or itching at the site, which means they reach to wherever the shingles is and they're scratching it. And then that blister breaks. That break in the skin then can allow infection to enter. And they're usually scratching with their fingernails, which fingernails have bacteria underneath them. People that have shingles are already immunocompromised, or they wouldn't have shingles to begin with. So anybody that develops shingles, their immune system's already in a weakened state. And then we're scratching with bacteria under our fingernails, which can then cause an infection and even make them septic, systemic infection.
Yeah. Again, so it's not so much the shingles, it's the scratching and breaking open the skin from the shingles.
That the blister formation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually, so then a wound could be anyone scratching a blister, and we get blisters for all kinds of things, right?
Correct. And or any scratch. And so even like, you know, people have heard of cat scratch fever. It's the cat.
Ted Nugent.
Yeah, Ted Nugent.
Yeah. He's still around, by the way. I have one of my employees is like a Ted Nugent fanatic, and I hear about Ted on a pretty consistent basis. So
yeah, when the cat scratches your skin, it causes a break in the skin,
right.
And then that bacteria under the cat's claws is what causes cat scratch fever.
Wow. Wow.
Ted Nugent for letting us all know about it. Right?
Yeah. I'm thinking maybe Ted either got it or knows somebody that got it, but we should probably have him on the show to talk about his experience with cat scratch.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. We could bring him on as maybe have like a round table. Okay. So you also have dermatological conditions are also can become a wound or they're listed on your document. So what is it about dermatology or dermatological issues, you know, that cause wounds?
I published an article called Simplifying the Complex: Best Practices for Managing Complex Wounds. Inside that article, I highlighted a case called dermatitis herpetiformis. That's a really big name. The short name is Döring's disease. This was a elderly lady that had skin eruptions, rashes for about 7 years by the time our company was consulted. Some of those eruptions were little tiny blisters, and she was scratching herself open. She had a very large wound on her bottom because she itched so bad, and she had end-stage dementia, and so she would scratch and scratch and scratch until she had holes in her body. So our company came in, actually biopsied those lesions, and it came back positive for essentially like an erythema or autoimmune type disorder. The biopsy led us to reach out to a registered dietitian because we realized it was something she was ingesting. They had already tried everything else. They had changed soaps and lotions and creams and bed linens, and they had done everything right, and yet she continued to have these eruptions. So after we reached out to the registered dietitian, we discussed her case, the history, what the biopsy showed. The dietitian said, you know, there's two types of things that elderly people ingest that can commonly cause this issue. One would be gluten and the other would be dairy. And we said, okay, how do we know? And the dietitian said, you eliminate one and then you wait about 3 to 6 months because that's how long it takes to clear it from the body. And about the 12-week mark, this lady was almost 100% completely resolved.
Just from going off gluten and dairy?
Just from going off gluten. We just eliminated gluten. And that severe gluten sensitivity, she didn't even have an allergy to gluten. It was a severe gluten sensitivity. So once we eliminated the gluten, her skin cleared up And that is a positive diagnosis then for dermatitis herpetiformis, otherwise known as Döring's disease.
Wow.
After 7 years of having this rash and blister formation and digging holes in her body because she itched so bad, she was finally able to have comfort and peace.
So, you know, when I was a teen and a young adult, I had a lot of acne. If you're scratching your acne, would that be considered a wound? We used to pop our pimples. Is that considered a wound or?
Yeah, there's different definitions for wounds versus ulcers. And so I would call it more of a skin condition. Mm-hmm. That scratching them can get them infected. And sometimes that actually leads to scar tissue. You'll see people with what they call them pox, but it's from scratching and having bacteria in the acne.
Right. And if you're really unlucky, then the bacteria gets into the bloodstream, it can, something as simple as just a small wound, not wound, but a small
break in the skin.
Mm-hmm. Or whatever, right, can actually become septic and can become a real problem.
We have another case that we're getting ready to publish. It hasn't been published yet, but it was our advanced wound specialist in Southwest Missouri. It was a gentleman in his 50s. And history is so important when it comes to identifying and diagnosing wounds and or skin issues and then determining what we call differential diagnostics need to be put in place. So you have this 50-year-old gentleman who has wounds on his legs. Everybody goes, oh, look at those venous wounds. And our advanced wound specialist said, I don't think so. These are erupting. It looks like you can almost see them starting under the skin and then they erupt. That doesn't look like a venous wound to me. And so this goes back to years of experience treating thousands of wounds. Sometimes your clinical gut tells you otherwise. So she biopsied it and it came back that he had a blood disorder, actually cancer, undiagnosed cancer of the blood. And so again, if we had delayed getting an advanced wound specialist involved that's used to seeing thousands of cases to that, you know, the primary care physicians, one, they don't treat wounds all day. They treat people all day. So that advanced wound specialist, because that's what she does all day, every day, she was able to say, no, my clinical gut tells me, now let me prove it. And then we were able to get him to a hematology oncology doctor instead of finding out much, much later through his disease process what he actually had.
Well, it sounds that that particular patient was very fortunate that that person had care being performed by someone in your organization. My concern kind of leads into my next question and something we kind of touched on earlier is that, and it's just from what I'm hearing, it doesn't look like the medical community is meeting the needs of not only the senior and elderly population as far as proper wound care diagnoses and treatment, but the general population as well. That sounds like that's the case, correct?
I think we have a long way to go. Long way to go, yep.
So just to kind of summarize, we talked about shingles and dermatological conditions. You see this a lot in seniors and elderly, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, because usually if someone has shingles that I hear about, they're definitely part of the aging population. And there's so many others that we could get into and maybe talk about on a future episode. We're going to get you up to double digits episodes at some point. You're only at two now, but I've got plans for you, Martha Kelso.
Perfect.
So
if I could interject, I would say the dangerous wound types are the ones that are going to end you up in amputation or death.
Okay.
The ones that you want to rule out the quickest are going to be arterial disease and diabetic. Because those are, if you don't have good blood flow, you're going to end up in an amputation or infarcted toes, right? Black toes that then fall off or have to be amputated. Diabetics, we know, end up in amputation. And it goes back to poor blood flow, atherosclerosis, microvascular impairment. It's rare to have a venous wound become amputated, right? It's also rare to have a, you know, dehisced surgical site that then becomes infected. So the two that are, I feel, most dangerous are arterial and diabetic. Keep in mind, though, about 60% of wounds have mixed disease. So they may have diabetes and arterial disease and venous disease and a pressure component.
But in general, the arterial and the diabetic, even if they have other comorbidities, those type of conditions are most susceptible to having to get an amputation.
Mm-hmm, 'cause their blood flow is impaired. And if we don't get on it, the outcome is not good. So somebody that has diabetes, arterial, and venous disease, they're what I call the trifecta for amputation.
Right.
Because their microvascular blood flow is impaired, their arterial blood flow is impaired, which is the one that goes away from the heart, and the venous blood flow is impaired. That's the one that returns back to the heart. And so if all three conditions exist, the chance of them ending up in amputation is huge. Huge. And that's if we do everything right. That's if we do everything right. So it's also why it's so important to get those studies involved so that, you know, the patient or the family can make informed decisions. Look, your mom has an 80% occlusion. She has extraordinary venous disease and she has microvascular impairment. There's not a whole lot we can do except try to keep her leg attached. The chance of that happening is not very good, but here's the things we're going to try. Probably needs to get out to a vascular surgeon. So I always feel like from a family standpoint, families cannot make informed decisions without information. And it's our job as medical providers to give the patient and the family the information they need to make an informed decision.
Okay. And just to clarify, occlusion, is that when an artery is blocked, preventing blood to get down to the different organs?
Correct.
Okay.
And not everybody's a surgical candidate, but at least if we can get them, get the issue identified, get them out to vascular, vascular can do the studies and have that conversation with the options. Here's your loved one's options. If the option is that they're not a surgical candidate, okay. Well, is there a medication we can try to help encourage their blood flow? Or are we, maybe we just need to put them on hospice and keep them comfortable. But to me, as the DPOA for my mother, I want to know what my options are.
So right.
I can make the best choice for my mother, whom I love dearly, you know.
Got it. So before we get into, because you actually created a checklist to monitor wounds to be able to make sure that everything that can be done is done in the form of a checklist. So if you're diabetic, and I'm sure we have some diabetics listening to this show, what is the best way to prevent getting a wound which would increase your chances of an amputation?
The American Diabetic Association has issued guidance, and it's great stuff. So I would get involved and be aware of what the American Diabetic Association recommends. So it's things like making sure that you have adequate shoe wear, actually assessed, evaluated, and prescribed by a medical provider that understands how to make sure you have the right shoe wear. Getting your feet assessed by someone other than you at least annually, if not twice annually. And Medicare pays for that, by the way. Medicare pays for an annual foot assessment. Knowing if you have neuropathy and how severe your neuropathy is. Neuropathy is you don't feel the same sensation as someone without diabetes. If your neuropathy is pretty severe, I've had people come into the wound center that had broken their toe and it's hanging off to the side, and they had no idea that their foot was broke because they were walking around without shoes on and they caught their toe on the end of a dresser.
And the neuropathy, it makes the foot numb, right?
And they didn't know.
Shuts down the sensations. Yeah.
I've had people come in with foreign objects, paper clips, sticking out of their foot, and they didn't know. Tacks and pins. And
I can tell you that I stepped on a tack once, and I know that I did not have neuropathy at that time because. Yeah, I hit the roof. Yeah, it was definitely very painful.
Yeah. And that neuropathy is kind of, you know, our pain, Steve, your pain is your protective sensation.
Right. Yeah.
The water's too hot. Don't put your toe in. You're going to get burned. Diabetics miss that protective sensation. So, you know, the wrong shoes not fitting correctly can rub a wound in a matter of minutes that then can end up in sepsis, amputation, osteomyelitis, all those bad, nasty words that nobody ever wants to hear, you know?
Wow. Okay. And that's just from wearing tight shoes.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. So we definitely want you to share about your transitions of care guide, which I looked at, and it is sensational. Anybody who is concerned about a wound definitely needs to get their eyes on this. And you have a wound care flag sample checklist. So can you briefly tell our injured senior community a little bit about it and then how they can get access to it?
Sure. The Transitions of Care Resource Guide was written by about 10 specialists that came together as a group. And it took us about a year, probably punting it back and forth, making sure that it vocalized what we needed it to say. And so inside of the Transitions of Care Guide, that group of 10 experts from around the country published the flag document. So what we did, the wound care flags, is written at a layperson standpoint. So somebody that has no clue about wounds knows if that wound is okay or not, whether that's, you know, your 80-year-old mother who now has to take care of their own wound, or maybe it's, you know, my mother taking care of my neighbor with a wound, or maybe it's a nurse that has no wound care training, or a primary care physician that doesn't know much about wounds. So we started with the green flag. Green flag is good signs. We're happy. The wound's doing what we want. So those are things like they have no fever. There's no wound odor. They're not having pain, or pain is less than it was previously. The wound drainage looks clear and there's no color involved. The skin surrounding the wound doesn't have redness or strange colors, and the size is decreasing. If those things are true, what do we want them to do? We want them to stay the course, keep doing what you're doing, and watch out for other flag signs that may tell us that the wound is starting to behave badly. Keep in mind, if they have blood sugar, diabetes, we want them to monitor their blood sugar and continue to talk with healthcare providers about how to best manage that wound.
Okay, so then, and it's like a traffic light. There's green, yep. There's orange, and there's red. So then the next, I guess the moderate type of wound situation would be an orange flag, correct?
Yeah, the caution, the yellow flag, that's kind of the caution, wait a minute, a little bit more attention to me. And that's if your wound drainage has increased, that's a concern. That would signify possible infection or inflammatory markers. Maybe the wound drainage is now bright yellow or blue-green, or there's even an odor involved.
You're talking about like pus that comes out, or?
Yep. Yeah. Could be pus, could be, I've seen green drainage that signifies Pseudomonas that may not be pus. Bright yellow signifies that there's been a change in the fluid, maybe from serous fluid to serosanguinous. Serosanguinous isn't necessarily bad, but most wound drainage that's healthy is going to be on the clear spectrum versus the, oh, now it's darker yellow switching to blue or green. We don't want that.
No.
If the wound starts getting bigger in size, it doesn't necessarily mean that the wound is infected, but maybe we're not keeping pressure off of it as much, or maybe their nutrition has declined. Maybe their level of oxygen getting to that wound has declined, but it tells us there's a change that we may not be happy about.
So if it gets to red, I mean, if you think that you're red, you should get the person to an emergency room or what?
Well, on the red flag, what we say is if they have fever, chills, or flu-like feeling, we want you to call your wound provider immediately and let them know what's different. We're still not freaking out yet. We're still not calling 911 because there is a certain amount of time, maybe 4 to 8 hours, where we can still intervene to keep them out of the emergency room. In mind, emergency room doctors, they're there to kind of put a patch or a band-aid on it, not necessarily figure out what's causing the underlying issue with the wound. Also, when you're seeing the wound for the first time and you don't know the history of the wound, you don't know if there's been cultures done, what it grew, what their albumin status is, they're kind of guessing at what to do with that wound. Unless if you're septic and need admitted to the hospital, that's a different story.
Well, I was going to say, if they've got a fever, and we've talked about in other episodes, Dr. Cosconi, he gave us a really great education on sepsis. And he said fever isn't always the number one sign to look for. It's mental confusion. So I guess if your loved one has a wound and you're in that red flag area and they have a fever, but if they also maybe exhibit some of the other signs of sepsis, which could be a fever or a high respiratory rate, or just feeling like they're going to die, you probably advise that they get into the emergency room, right?
Yeah, if they're in a long-term care building, they can do blood work that very quickly tells us, and very quickly meaning, in under 8 hours, they can draw a stat CBC, complete blood count. And if their white blood cell count is extraordinarily elevated and they have a significant left shift, that's somebody that has to go to the ER. Get them out of the woods, get them stabilized.
Got it.
But even things like severe pain, that's not normal for wounds. They might have moderate or mild pain, but severe pain where they're crying and they're bent over and grabbing that wound, that is a clear sign usually of infection or possible blood flow that's been cut off. You think about if you sit on your leg too long and then you see how painful that is, that can occur in somebody with significant arterial disease. So anything with a significant change, we want to get our medical providers involved, your primary care doctor, your wound specialist, your home health nurse, get them involved so that they can try to, a few other things that will keep you out of the woods, or they can clearly say, sorry, I'm worried about sepsis. Let's get you to the ER so they can initiate sepsis protocol.
How many wounds actually become infection? In general, do you have any idea what the percentages of wounds that become infectious?
I don't know what the clinical research says. In our company, just what we treat a week, it's anywhere from 15 to 20%. Now, that's infection. All wounds, in my opinion, have bacteria. But bacteria doesn't necessarily signal, okay, well, now it's down in the tissue and it's causing problems and making an issue. That's infection.
Got it. And with proper wound care, they'll never get to that point. But as you have eloquently described it, it is not a pretty situation as far as the skill level of our medical establishment to be able to diagnose and properly treat wounds. And
I will say that, insurance payers have some ownership in this too. And it's actually one of my ongoing sources of contention. In the long-term care setting, you expect us to heal these sometimes very large, egregious wounds that have been there for years, but you don't cover the tools that I need to heal them. And we're starting to see kind of a paradigm shift where maybe skin grafts or skin substitutes are now covered in long-term care in some areas. But, to have a wound for 7 years and I have a limited toolbox with tools in it to heal that wound, where at the hospital or at the wound centers, they have numerous tools to help, is kind of frustrating, especially when it's a 90-year-old that doesn't want to transfer 45 minutes one direction once or twice a week in 20-degree weather. And so I will say that some of it is getting access to the proper tools through insurance payers to let us heal those wounds.
Well, I would think Medicare would take the lead on that. They've got so many regulations for the long-term care settings that I'm surprised that wound care hasn't been adequately addressed.
Mm-hmm. I've been emailing some of the MACs, the Medicare, the local administrative coverage people, trying to push the envelope and getting coverage for some of these other things. And I've had some success. And I think sometimes, it's our job to ask and it's their job to say no. But if we don't at least ask, maybe they don't realize that we need it.
There you go. Okay, so how can our injured senior community get a copy of the wound care flag checklist? Because that sounds like that's really, really important for anybody, that is a senior or elder. That's something that should have in their toolbox.
any of the documents we've talked about today, they can find on our website on the online library page, which is free. They don't have to register. I'm not collecting their email addresses or anything. They can simply download it. And that's at www.mywoundcareplus.com. And then again, just go to the online library page. There's training videos, there's podcasts on here. But if you go down, that's where a lot of these documents that I've authored or co-authored, and there's even some other best practice documents on there that I didn't author that are from other people that are just good information to have.
That's great. So that's all in the online library.
Yes.
Okay. And if anyone wants to follow you on social media or get in touch with you, why don't you give us a rundown of your social media portfolio?
Sure.
And your email address.
I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And my company is on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. And then if anybody needs to reach out to our company, they can email office@mywoundcareplus.com. Or on our website, there's a contact us page that gets to the same email address. Or our number is 888-256-3814. And the people answering the phones can help them get to those articles on our website as well, or get their email address so we can email it to them, whatever's easiest.
Wonderful. That's great. Darn, Martha, already our time's up.
It goes so fast.
Yeah, I know. I mean, really, it's been like 45 minutes. So
you always make me put my thinking hat on, Steve. Questions.
Hey, you know, we know that there is, it's like a vault. You've got a vault inside your head. So I'm like a bank robber. Like I'm going in there, like just taking stacks of money and taking it out of that vault. So I'm trying to take stacks of information out of that vault. So yeah, it is really, really just so fortunate that we're able to get you on to share all of this great information. And we're going to have to get you back for a third time and talk about, again, delve deeper into a lot of the issues that you brought up, because you really, really brought up a lot of good stuff. But again, I want to thank you, all kidding aside, I want to thank you, and looking forward to, again, to talking to you soon. We're working on a webinar that we're going to be presenting to, could be professionals that are looking for more continuing education, or just anybody who wants to get more information about wound care. And we will be, or at least I will be, giving more information about that on upcoming shows. So we're going to talk about that when we get off air. So thanks, Martha. Injured Senior Community, if you have any questions for me, or want us at the National Injured Senior Law Center to investigate a potential case, feel free to email me at any time at steve@injuredseniorhotline.com. It used to be info@injuredseniorhotline.com, but we were able to get it to steve@injuredseniorhotline.com. So you know it's definitely coming to me. Also, if you would like to audition to be a guest on this show so you can come on and talk about any type of situation that you had as an injured senior, such as medical malpractice, elder abuse, again, any type of story that could enhance our knowledge or experiences, at least give us more information and just examples of things that have happened to everyone, and definitely would educate us on how we can avoid that happening in the future. Or just to learn about your experience, again, you can email me at steve@injuredseniorhotline.com. We'd love to have you on. So if you like the content that was discussed today, and Martha gave us just an avalanche of so much good stuff, and a lot of stuff. So if you didn't write it all down, you can go to our show notes, and that will have a summary of today's show and any important links that we mentioned. Also, always feel free to reach out to me again about your own story, or if you have any questions, steve@injuredseniorhotline.com. Also, please subscribe to our podcast and rate and review. So thanks again for listening to today's show. Be sure to tune in to next week's show. And if you're in certain parts of the country where it's steamy hot, stay cool. I look forward to talking with you next week. Okay, take care now. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Injured Senior Podcast with Steve H. Heisler. If you enjoyed the podcast, please rate, subscribe, review, and share on Apple, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. To find out more or to get help anytime, go to InjuredSeniorHotline.com or call 855-622-6530. We'll see you next time.